by Monsignor Tony Rogers. Here on Radio 4 FM, we continue our Book of the Week on Silbury Hill by Adam Thorpe. We join the author on All Hallows Eve 2013. It's also the Celtic festival of Samhain, which marks the end of harvest and has ancient pagan roots, celebrating an occasion when the dead can return to their earthly homes. In the heart of Wiltshire's Neolithic landscape, Thorpe is keen to reach the venerated Swallowhead Spring before nightfall. The reader is Philip Franks.
Skirting Silbury by the east side, I hurry over the A4's self-important tarmac and onto the track that leads you up to the ridge and to West Kennet Long Barrow. After a few yards, I veer off across an open-access field, once a managed water meadow, and, hidden at an even deeper depth of time, the teeming Roman settlement, conjured by a recent geophysical survey, which showed, like an X-ray, a web of streets, alleys, and house plots. This is unlikely ever to be fully excavated. The relevant authorities reckoned that it would turn the area into an even hotter spot for tourists, necessitating a new infrastructure and destroying what calm still remains around the Neolithic sites. Presumably that's what it was in the first place. Noisy, a busy staging post on the way between the sacred waters of Aquaesulis and Londinium. Meet the gods, have a massage, drink from the ritual wells, buy some knick-knacks. The spring, part source of the River Kennet, lies beyond the corner of the field and over some large sarsen stepping stones and a little wooden footbridge. The immediate area is a beautiful haven of slender reeds and old leaning willows. The usual pagan offerings, ribbons and wickerwork pentangles, dangle between the leaves. There is no sign of water today, only a scoured serpent of gravel and sand between tussocks and the green silvery reeds. The nymphs are departed, as Eliot put it in the wasteland, musing on the Thames. No nymphs here either, unless the two middle-aged women in jeans and blue cagoules, pink-dominated wellies and generous beaded shawls are a canny update. They are talking excitedly by the largest sallow, whose low, thick branches necessitates a propitiatory dip of the head. The spring has been a popular pilgrimage site for years. The two women are holding large, flat drums. Goatskin, they tell me. One drum's tautness is painted with four trees depicting the different seasons, their roots meeting to make a circle in the middle. Robin and Kim, who are about my vintage, are excited because when taking a photograph of the spring a few moments before, the digital screen had been obscured by a deep blue ectoplasmic presence that wobbled about for a bit and then floated off. They both saw it, although I'm not sure if it was also visible off-screen. Being a Buddhist in the pre-Tibetan Bon tradition, with its roots in indigenous animism and sympathetic magic, Robin is certain that it was Menla, the Bon medicine deity. I step towards the spring with warnings to be careful. I like my new friends. They are friendly and enthusiastic, and they welcomed me when they might have resented a male presence. The welcome intensified when I told them I had known the area from boyhood and had a thing about Silbury. I was recognised as one of their own. I have always been susceptible to the tofu-knitting, yoghurt-weaving world. There are degrees of flakiness, of course, defined by the usual criteria which might apply to anything from railway modelling to fundamentalist Islam. Taking it too seriously, going on about it, being blind to any other mode of belief. Hitler and Himmler, remember, were worryingly flaky, keen on stone circles, vegetarianism, Arthurian legends, dark forests and fire ceremonies. That should keep us all on our toes when we wish the world back to a New Age version of the Neolithic. The natural chalk is now covered in thick grass and sedge, with a flat stone half concealing the spring's outflow hole, a mantelpiece for votive knick-knacks. I lift my tiny digital camera and notice on its screen a tussock with a blue tint to the left of the hole. I tell the women on my return, showing the result. The shade of blue has faded to the mere suggestion of a nuance, and Robin scoffs in her New Zealander's lilt. Ours was really, really blue. and took up almost the whole screen, hovering. Kim is a local and tells me the story that her father would tell her when she was small. A cobbler sits on a huge heap of shoes he's busy mending when the dragon arrives. It usually features the devil, but this was a kid's version. The latter asks how far it is to Marlborough, which he wishes to incinerate. "It's so far," the cobbler replies niftily, "that coming back, I've already worn out all these shoes." The dragon turns round and is never seen again. The pile of shoes turns into Silbury Hill. This is, in fact, a delightfully garbled version of the traditional folk tale told about Silbury. The devil was carrying a huge spadeful of earth that he wished to dump on Marlborough, and threw it aside when hearing the cobbler's cunning reply. It was the spadeful of earth that became Silbury. But I think Kim's dad's version is more evocative. Silbury blurring into the battered traces of a long journey. Worn out souls, as it were. As I leave Swallowhead, Kim and Robin drum me out. The fading beat rising from the trees behind seems to push me gently forward, cradling me, giving me a subtle strength. I am touched by the way it continues, almost inaudible, until my speck of a figure reaches the track on the far side. At the age of 19, I was invited, through a friend whose father was a leading archaeologist, to join a dig on an important Neanderthal site in Jersey, a coastal ravine that served as a hunting shelter from 238,000 BC to as recently as 40,000 BC, when it was occupied by some of the last surviving Neanderthals. The cave would have commanded a gully-fissured landscape now concealed by the English Channel, roamed by mammoth, deer, rhino, wild horses, and wolves. I was assigned the hearth, which I had to picture as a long, unbroken column of ash. I remember my trowel striking something hard, the axe's bulk growing through the damp sediment until it was finally seeing sunlight for the first time in some 135,000 years. The last eye to settle on it, the last hand to cradle it as mine was doing, did not belong to Homo sapiens sapiens, but to a species of human with a bigger brow ridge, no chin, and a larger jaw, who clustered in tiny groups of about five or six in a relatively unpopulated world and suffered as a result from serious inbreeding. Yet I felt as if the owner of this wondrous tool was whispering to me. The 5,000 years of recorded history, since Sumer, or the first pyramids, or Silbury Hill, shriveled into insignificance. It was a profound moment of internal readjustment that has never left me. How did Neolithic folk view time? Maybe, in one sense, they never viewed it at all, not as something abstract or separate. There was no piecework or hourly rate in the late Neolithic. There was no money. So time was not bound up with monetary value, nor was it measured precisely. Time was merely effect, a fading flower, the sun touching the hill, a distant memory, an accumulation of chalk. Maybe time didn't bother them as such. The building of Silbury Hill went on for decades, perhaps a century or more. The archaeologist Mike Parker Pearson reckons it would take 1,000 people working full-time for 2 years to build a modern version. Half an hour ago, an infinitesimal sliver, I was being drummed across the field by Kim and Robin. Time is not what my watch says, although it is growing so dark that I can't read it properly and I don't have a mobile, but a distance. The long strides between myself as I stand here and the drumming. The track up to West Kennet Long Barrow's high ridge from the A4 is pale enough to stand out in the quickening darkness. Kim said that folk would be gathering here towards midnight, a modern tradition, summoning the dead spirits or just imbibing the vibes of this long wedge of burial mound in otherwise featureless ploughland. From the track, its 350 feet stretch out along the ridge. For 1,000 years, between 3,500 BC and 2,500 BC, locals brought their kith and kin here to be entombed. Like Silbury, it would have been chalk white, a brilliant crest visible for miles around, like the first inklings of foam on a smooth breaker. White death against green life. The immediate woodland cleared for the clan's mausoleum. A muffled boom, boom, boom. As I approach the slabbed forecourt, dim and confusing in the twilight, there's a scuffle of feet, and the drumming heartbeat stops. I circle the barrow for a few moments, its length like an inky mountain range against the deepening blue. Then I go in, finding the hip-wide slit between the sarsens that guard the entrance by its flickery glow. As usual, my ears feel tamped, as if entering an anechoic chamber. No wonder the drum sounded muffled. A long-haired woman with a stout candle has made her own sanctuary right in its far depths. And here I am, crouched, awkward between the bulky stones, the chambers either side dressed in smaller beeswax candles dripping onto the sarsen ledges. My maleness never so evident to me as right now. She is dressed entirely in black and has very long silvery white hair, although she is certainly younger than me. Ageless, perhaps. I spot the worry in her eyes as I stand up straight in the final circular chamber, so I smile goofily and say a very un-Neolithic, "Hi there." The round chamber is small, and we fill it. I wonder briefly if she's a Satanist, rather than a straightforward pagan, as the barrow has long been a favourite with a variety of cults. Wadges of wax have collected on the ledges, along with the usual offerings. It even smells like a Catholic shrine. 30 years ago, I found in the depths what we called then a rubber johnny. Whether used for ritualistic purposes or a simple quickie, I have no idea, along with an empty bottle of beer. The place reeked of piss and damp. I'm finding that I don't want to stay in here. There's a sultry heaviness, a sense that I'm not wanted, a kind of torpid reluctance to welcome me in. Perhaps I'm just picking up the woman's thoughts. I break the silence by saying how the candles make it look special. It's true. The flickering, darting shadows on the rock walls, the scent of beeswax and incense, have cancelled the damp sterility of a place disemboweled by archaeology. "They do, yes," she said. "Very peaceful." She gives a nervous chuckle, as English people do when feeling shy. Not very forthcoming, but neither am I. Words just seem to flop in here. Outside, I am glad to be alone again. A fresh night breeze is blowing over the expanses of grass and ploughland. I stumble back on the very last dregs of the sunset, the absence of moon rendering the track periodically gully-like. Just below the metal gate, about halfway down, I sense something racing towards me from below. I glimpse a little figure in animal hides, arms held forward above the head and holding up a kind of large cape as if sheltering under it. Deerskin, it looks like, with pale speckles. The apparition rustles past me. It makes a strange sort of whispering or hissing sound as it runs. And so extraordinary a vision is this that I stop, seriously wondering if it isn't another time slip, another Neolithic conjuring. A few seconds later, I am disappointed to hear the solid click of the gate latch. The surface has not broken, after all.
Philip Franks continues reading from On Silbury Hill by Adam Thorpe, tomorrow at the same time. It's abridged and produced by Jill Waters, and it's a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. After the news, Woman's Hour includes the story of Claudia Jones, the civil rights activist who established the forerunner to London's Notting Hill Carnival. And later this morning here on Radio 4, Alan Little returns to Sarajevo 20 years after he reported from there during the siege. Back then, against the odds, the city's cultural life flourished, including at the theatre, despite audiences and actors risking their lives to be there. How did the arts help to restore the city's identity? And what did a certain play by Samuel Beckett have to do with it? Still Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo is at 11:30 this morning.